Today, the Science Magazine of the Air brings you the story of the one instrument that has brought pleasure and enjoyment to millions of people. Some believe more than any other invention of mankind. The one instrument that for the past 80 years has faithfully recorded the history of man, his works, his progress, his life. We present...
Lights! Action! Action! Camera!
Ladies and gentlemen, today, for experimental purposes, we have built this, for want of a better word, let's call it a camera. It's rectangular in shape, made of cardboard. In fact, it's nothing but a big, square cardboard box about the size of a small room. It's a strange camera, but it's all ours. All right, Eddie, are you ready to be lowered into the camera?
All set, Professor.
Then lower away, men. Just hang on to the rope, Eddie. We'll get you down all right.
Don't worry. I'm hanging on.
Are you all right, Eddie?
Okay, Professor.
Good. All right, men. Pull up the rope and lock the opening. Now, our subject is down inside the camera. Probably the first man in history to be in such an enviable position. Now, with this experiment, we are going to observe...
Professor,
just.
Hey, Professor!
Oh, my word, I completely forgot. Eddie, can you hear me?
Just about.
Then listen carefully. There's a chair right around where you're standing. I think to your left.
Ouch!
Oh, you found it.
Oh, I found it, all right.
Good. Now, sit down in the chair. Now, on the right arm of the chair, there's an intercom set. Now, strap it on your head. Eddie, have you found the intercom?
I found it, Professor.
Can you hear me better now?
Oh, fine, Professor. Fine.
Good. Now, Eddie, would you kindly tell the class what it's like where you are?
Well, it's like nothing.
Yeah, nothing.
It's black. Black as the ace of spades in here. I can't see anything. I just put my hand up in front of my face and I wriggle my fingers.
Yes?
Well, I can't even see them.
Good. Now, ladies and gentlemen, that's how it is inside every camera. Complete darkness. Or, as Eddie put it, black is the ace of spades. Now, right here in my hand, I have a pin. An ordinary pin. With it, I puncture one end of our big cardboard box like this. It's rather a large ordinary pin.
Hey, Professor.
What is it, Eddie?
There's a little spot of light way down at the far end.
Yeah, I know. I just made it. Describe for the class how it is inside now.
Well, I already described it. A pinpoint of light and nothing.
Now, turn around, Eddie, chair and all, and face the other end of the box. Now, what do you see?
I see you.
Where?
Well, reflected on the back wall.
What am I doing?
You're standing on your head. No. Hanging upside down. Wait a minute. I'm all mixed up.
No, Eddie, you're not. I am standing on my head, and I am upside down. Everything you see on that back wall, Eddie, is inverted. Now, friends, that's all there is to getting a picture. We have added all kinds of improvements. Trick lenses, speed lenses, telescope lenses, infrared and color filters. Oh, 101 different gadgets. But no matter how complex the camera is, they all work on this one basic principle. A dark box and a tiny hole, and the refraction of light will throw an exact image of the outside world within the dark box. Now, this principle was known back in the times of ancient China, Greece, and in Rome. The great Italian painter, Leonardo da Vinci, experimented in this field. Only his camera was a large tent to make the dark room, and a small window in it instead of the pinpoint as we have used. It was a great...
What have you now? What devil's trick is this that I must come out in the full heat of midday and stand perspiring inside this dark tent?
If your excellency will wait to see...
See, I see nothing in this darkness, not even you.
One moment. I will open this small wooden shutter in the side of the tent.
Huh?
Now look. Look, your excellency. Upon the white cloth.
No, I will not look. I will... Oh, it's my palace. and the garden, and the hills beyond, and everything stands on its head. I'll call the guards. The devil has possessed you.
There is no devil in this, Your Excellency. It is something known to the ancients. I have but added a glass lens, and that is all.
Oh.
Here are no tricks.
Oh, look, Leonardo, look. They changed the guard now before the palace gate.
Yes.
And oh, my wonderful Leonardo, here in this dark and tent upon a few inches of white cloth, you've captured my entire world. Oh, to wonder beyond wonders. Leonardo,
yes, my lord.
It's fading. The image on the white cloth, it's fading.
Yes, I know, my lord. You came late.
Well, stand up there like a dumb ox. Stop it. Keep it.
I cannot.
Oh, it's going. Bring it back. I command you.
That I cannot do, my lord. Nor can the wisest man in the world obey your command. When outside the light of day departeth, then the picture here within the tent must go too.
And so, friends, in the days of Leonardo da Vinci, man had seen and recognized the image, but none had ever succeeded in capturing it. All the beauty of the world was there, in the darkness of the camera obscura, but with the dying of the sun, it was gone as if it had never been. And for hundreds of years after da Vinci, the beautiful image still defied capture, defied recording, until at last in Paris, on a warm summer's day in 1823, in the studio of a painter named Louis Jacques Daguerre, two men sat. The painter and the friend.
Why do we draw all the shades and sit here in the darkness? Are your eyes tired?
No, my eyes are quite all right. I'm waiting.
For what?
To see if it comes again.
Are you sure you'll feel all right, Louis? Perhaps if you were to lie down.
Oh, I'm sorry. I should have explained before. Yesterday, I was sitting here alone, just as we're sitting here now, with the shades drawn against the heat. And suddenly, I noticed a picture of a tree in sunlight flickering on that canvas over there. That one against the wall.
Yes, I see.
Well, with my eyes, I followed the thin beam of light to the tiny crack in the shade. Yes. The picture on the canvas was an image of the tree outside the house.
But this is nothing to be excited about, Louis. Other men have seen this sun image. I have seen it myself. It comes and goes with the sun.
Yes, I know, but that wasn't what was strange. I left the studio, and I returned hours later. The sun was gone.
Yes.
But the image was still there on that canvas. I stared at it for hours until it finally faded away.
Louis, are you sure that
Oh, please. I don't know for sure, but I think I've stumbled on something. On something big. Because I remembered that that section of the canvas had been painted with paint that contained iodine.
And you think that it was the iodine that caught and held the image?
I do.
Now, look here, Louis.
Wait a minute. There comes the beam of sunlight, almost as it did yesterday. And you see, there on that spot where I put even more iodine, the image of the tree flickering.
Yes, I see it, but that still doesn't mean anything.
Well, I'll raise the shades. I'll raise them all the way. Now look. Now go on. Look close and look. Is the image still there on the canvas, or is it not?
It's here.
At last, a man, Louis Jacques Daguerre, had held the image captured, if only for a few fleeting hours. Filled with enthusiasm, Daguerre dreamed of capturing it forever. He joined forces with another enthusiast, Joseph Nietz. For several years, they worked together, experimenting. Nietz with bitumen of Judea, Daguerre with compounds of silver. They made crude pictures, but it took them a long time, hours, in fact, for the necessary exposure to the light. Joseph Nieff died, and his son Isidore took his place. Then there came a day.
Isidore! Yes? Isidore, look. Have you ever seen anything like it?
Why, it's wonderful. By far the best picture I've ever seen. How did you get it?
I didn't get it. It got itself.
What?
Yesterday I was making another picture with my camera obscura. But just as I started to expose, clouds darkened the sun. So, in disgust, I yanked the metal plate out of the camera, and I threw it into the closet. Well, just this minute, I picked it up. And look. Look at that beautiful picture.
But what was in the closet?
Nothing. Only old tools. Apparatus.
Let's take a look. Something must have made that picture.
Hey, see? There's nothing in there. Just as I said.
What's this?
Huh?
Here on the shelf with the plates.
For that? Well, that's nothing but a dish of metallic mercury.
Isidore, you don't think there's nothing else in there? It must be the mercury.
The first real photographic picture, the daguerreotype, came into being. Anyone who has looked through an old family album has seen a daguerreotype, generally framed in a plush page, covered with glass, and looking slightly faded. The fad for daguerreotypes spread like wildfire through the United States. Every little town and village had its daguerrean gallery. Advertisements were spectacular, and photographers were artists.
Mademoiselle, Madame Watson, I am honored. Delighted to see you. You are right on time for your appointment.
Oh, Mr. Johnson, do I look all right? I thought my deep lavender silk in this white lace.
Madame, there is no word to describe, except perhaps magnificent. Now, if you would just take your seat in this chair.
Oh, no, not sitting. Bessie, that's my sister-in-law, had one taken standing full length, and what Bessie can have, I can.
Oui, of course. Standing it shall be. Now, if Madame will just stand here under this chair.
Oh, Bessie's always putting on such airs. You think they'll catch you in a bank, need as much money. A man with a business of his own.
Yes, of course. Mrs. Watson, if you will just please place your right hand on
the... Why, just the other day, I let Bessie go with me anywhere. She had on that old pink dress and a little hat, the one with the egrets that she sells comes from Paris. But I know, because Mrs. Mr. Johnson, what are you doing to me?
I must put this clamp on the back of Madame's head. The head must be absolutely rigid.
Oh, very well, but not too tight, mind you. It was Mrs. DeVry who told me about Bessie's hat.
Yes.
She goes to the dressmaker, the one that sharp neck.
Yes.
Oh, there you, Mr. Johnson.
It is only the clamp for the back. The body, too, must be absolutely
original. Look, Philip, I thought I was going to be trussed up like a chicken.
One tiny movement will spoil the entire picture.
What are you doing now?
It is only a powder puff with white on it. I cover your face with white, see, like this, and we have a much better picture.
Oh, this is horrible. I can't move. I can't breathe. I let off with powder up my nose.
Oh, Passion, Madame Passion. Now, just this last clamp for the face.
You were saying about your sister-in-law, huh?
Oh, Bessie. Well, I don't know how well you know her, but she's really a lovely person.
Oui.
Except, of course, when she has those headaches.
Madame Watson,
we are ready now to take the picture. Remember?
Yes?
Absolutely. No talking.
Many people describe the process of having a daguerreotype made as worse than being placed on a torturer's rack. And for all the trouble, you got only one picture. No copies. Then in the middle 1800s, the wet plate was discovered. A process that gave you a glass negative from which any amount of prints could be taken. And the daguerreotype became as extinct as the dodo. And just about this time, there sprang into eminence a photographer without peer. A portraitist of such excellence that all the great and near great of America sat for him. Matthew B. Brady. Cameraman to a new nation. He photographed such men as Washington Irving, James Fenimore Cooper, Edgar Allan Poe, Andrew Jackson, Daniel Webster, Ulysses S. Grant, Robert E. Lee, and still one other. Abraham Lincoln. Candidate for the 16th President of the United States. And it was Matthew Brady who gives us this description of Abraham Lincoln when he first came to the Brady Gallery, an unknown political contender from Illinois.
He was over 6 feet 4 inches tall, with his legs out of all proportion to his body. His ears were large, his nose long and blunt, his chin projecting far and sharp, curved upward to meet a thick lower lip. His cheeks were flabby. Loose skin fell in wrinkles. There was a large mole on his right cheek and an uncommonly prominent Adam's apple. If ever a sitter presented a problem to a photographer, he was it. When I got him before the camera, I asked him if I might arrange his collar. And as I pulled it up, he said, I see you want to shorten my neck. And I said, that's just it. And we both laughed. Finally, we got a picture. A good one. And he went off to Cooper Union to make a speech.
And it was of Mr. Brady and his photograph that the newly elected president made this remark.
Brady and the Cooper Union speech made me president.
But Lincoln was not president long before the tension between the North and South flared into open violence. Fort Sumter was fired upon. Lincoln called for volunteers. It was civil war, family against family, brother against brother, the stars and stripes against the stars and bars. The Army of the Potomac marched out from Washington, bands playing, banners flying. And with the Army of the North, into all battles, went a strange wagon. A dark room mounted on wheels. A wagon known to the soldiers as the What Is It wagon. A wagon through whose dark insides would pass the actual pictures in the history of man. Of man's savagery against his fellow man. The first records of war. And on the wagon's box, the reins in his hands, sat Matthew Brady.
I felt I had to go. The spirit in my feet said go, and I went. The people back home want to see what war is like. My camera shows it to them. In all its false glory. In all its true horror.
And the newspapers of the day commented on the pictures Brady was sending back.
Mr. Brady has done something to bring home to us the terrible reality and earnestness of war. If he has not brought bodies and laid them in our dooryards and along our streets, he has done something very much like it. Crowds of people are constantly going up the stairs to the Brady Gallery. Follow them and you will find them bending over photographic views of the fearful battlefield taken immediately after the act.
Here. Mabel says, the dead of Antietam.
I can't, John. I can't look anymore. All those dead boys.
Never seen anything like it. Never was nothing like it, I guess. Just as if you were there yourself. It's so real, you can even see the buzzards in the sky. And look, there in the corner, there's a Johnny Reb, dead, sprawled right on top of one of our own boys.
Please, John, no more. I didn't know the war could be so horrible.
Brady took over 20,000 negatives, pictures rarely equal for artistic merit, pictures made under the greatest of all photographic handicaps, the wet plate. The miracle of photography gained impetus with every passing year. Wet plates, then dry plates, then better cameras, faster lenses, then Eastman Kodak with this rolled film. And all America seemed to be walking around with a Brownie camera in their hands. And then at last, men began to think of moving pictures. Films that would actually catch man as he moved and walked and played.
Mr. Edison, a package has arrived from Mr. Eastman in Rochester.
Good. Must be the 50 feet of that new celluloid film that I ordered. And it might work, and it might not, but it ought to be worth the $250 it cost.
But, Mr. Edison, I still don't see how this is going to help you make pictures move, no matter how long the roll of film.
Well, I'll make a series of pictures, long ribbon of them.
But then you'll only have a long series of pictures and a single roll of film. But that will make them move.
No, of course not. I doubt very much if anything or anyone will make a single picture move. But if we were to pass this long ribbon of pictures very rapidly before the lens, it may give a complete illusion of movement. At least we can try it. It might work. It might just work.
It worked. And the moving picture camera was born. In the due course of time, theaters sprang up across the nation, across the world. A new entertainment medium came into being. The silent movies. Silent movies like the classic Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse, with the never-to-be-forgotten Rudolph Valentino and his partner, Alice Terry.
Mr. Valentino, your special mood music is all ready, sir.
Very well.
Set ready now. All right. Now, stand by. Let's make it the tape now. Mood music all set, John?
That's it.
Ready, Mr. Valentino?
Ready.
Miss Terry?
Ready.
Right. Action! 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 Action!
Miss Terry, you kept talking to Mr. Valentino all through this take. I saw you.
Of course I was speaking to him. I always whisper to Rudolph when we dance for the screen. What difference does it make? No one can hear us.
If I've told you once, I've told you 100 times that whenever the lips move on the screen, the audience expects subtitles. And besides, there are lip readers.
Pooh, that's silly. I can talk and no one will hear. The screen is as silent as the grave.
Mammy, Mammy, the sunshine is...
Not quite as silent as the grave, Miss Terry. The birth of sound came with all the suddenness of a thunderclap and swept all before it. Theater after theater clamored for sound equipment. More and more requests came in for the movies to show sound pictures. The revolution was on. Hollywood was converting its entire industry to talking pictures. The result was, for a time, near chaos.
I am a director with no actors, no cameramen, no technicians. Make movies, they say. Make talking pictures. I asked for actors, and what happens?
I don't know, Mr. Gregson.
I know.
Oh, naturally, Mr. Gregson.
Use stage actors, they say. Stage actors. And they say make a silent version, too. One version talking, one version silent, with the same actors. But stage actors can't make silent movies, and the silent actors can't make talkies. It's a madhouse. A madhouse.
Yes, Mr. Gregson.
A madhouse. Hollywood had to learn its trade all over again. Engineers had to learn how to put the sound directly on the film instead of using a synchronized record. But Hollywood learned how to make pictures all over again. Pictures with sound. And in the field of pure science, the camera and photography made gigantic strides forward. From a state of non-existence a few short decades ago, it has become one of the many instruments with which man conquers the natural world about him. And, like other tools of science, it speaks in many tongues, in many languages. Cameras that record the beginnings of life. Cameras that watch the death struggle of worlds. Cameras that speak with authority. Cameras that speak for themselves.
Here there is nothing but the deepest silence and the utter darkness, broken now and again by the whirling nebulae and the soft river of the middle world. I am the spectrograph camera. I am the photographer of the universe. The whirlpools of the sun are my familiars. The canals of Mars are my waterways. The rings of Saturn, my stepping stones. The 9 moons of Jupiter, my... Through my efforts and mine alone, man has photographed the universe. I have recorded stars so distant that the light by which I have photographed them in solid earthhood more than 100 million years ago. Spectrograph who has replaced the astronomer of old with his weak eyes screwed to the end of the telescope. I and I alone. Who is it that dares to interrupt?
Me, me. I don't know. Never mind. You know who. The micrograph camera, that's who. Always talking, always blowing yourself up big. It's one of the other cameras put up with.
Why, you little.
No interrupting, please.
Quiet.
Who's that?
Me, infrared. Who? Who?
Now, listen, you
Let a camera who is a camera talk. I photograph something neither one of you can even see. Spooky, isn't it? Infrared rays, that's what. Rays that nobody but me can see. Quiet, little one. I flew in the belly of a bomber and photographed at night or through clouds Hitler's Fortress Europa so that our bombardiers had an easy job.
But I take photographs above the height you fly.
But I take them where you can't see.
I am the one.
Yes. They will quarrel, and always about the one subject, their usefulness to man, who, and I'm sure they've quite forgotten this, invented them all. And I'm afraid they're going to get a new member in their ranks, who, in all probability, will try to be cock of the walk. Television camera. Commercial television is here, and more of it is on its way. Furthermore, scientists and engineers already envision the day when each individual will carry his own portable television sender and screen. When that time comes, no man need be further away by sight or sound than by simply throwing a switch. No man need be lonely. No man will be forgotten.
Professor? Oh, Professor!
Who's that?
Well, it's me, Eddie, inside the camera. Unlock the door.
Eddie, I'm sorry. I forgot all about you. My word. I believe I've lost the key.
This has been another program presented by the Armed Forces Radio Service for you men and women in the Army, Navy, and Marine Corps. This has been the dramatization of the dreams of man come through science. We invite you to be with us next week for another page of the Science Magazine of the Air. The Armed Forces Radio Service, the voice of information and education.